Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Eric Saratella. Saratella is a potter and an award-winning ceramics artist. His work has appeared in galleries and festivals around the country, including the Del Mano Gallery in Los Angeles and the Smithsonian Craft Festival in Washington, D.C. He's the founder of Muddy Paws, a local pottery production business, and is currently guest curator of a local ceramic show at Cornell's Johnson Museum. The show is due to open in July. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, you had a very successful career in the corporate world when in 1996 you took a pottery class, and it changed your life. Tell us.
I took a class as a creative outlet, put my hands in clay, and immediately was in love with it. I was totally drawn to it. I had no intention of it becoming a career necessarily, but after the six-week session, I continued in clay and worked in the teacher's studio for about 2 years. We became friends. He was actually an ex-football player, so we'd watch football on Sunday and have some beer and make pots.
And
that was really how I learned to make pots, and it's really what launched me as what was originally a production potter.
Uh-huh. And so what is it that stole your soul about this craft?
You know, if we get really kind of spiritual about it, I'm an earth sign, and maybe I was just drawn to the clay and the dirt. And on a simpler level, it's just a really sensuous type of art form. I loved having my hands in the clay. I love the fact that you could just start with a lump of earth and form it into, you know, beautiful, moving, dancing forms that were in many cases usable.
Uh-huh. And then this isn't something you never did this as a kid, like kids get little clay sets and
I didn't. You know, I took I remember my sixth grade art teacher, Mr. Volpe, and I made a coffee mug, and this was back in the 70s. You know, everybody made ashtrays and coffee mugs.
Exactly.
And I actually found that mug, and I can remember glazing it, and being Italian, I'm really into lots of color, and I dipped it in every single glaze, and it turned out this putrid green. It's really ugly. So I do have my original pot, but from sixth grade until in my 30s, I really didn't do anything with clay. Did photography more as a creative hobby.
Uh-huh. So you discovered this intense affinity to clay and this craft. Did you decide that you had to study when you became serious?
Well, my career in clay really sort of evolved naturally. As I mentioned, Lloyd Fitzsimmons, who was my first teacher, was a production potter. So I kind of grew up in this production mentality, make the same thing over and over again, take it to a craft show and sell it. So while I was working, I was an advertising executive. I just started making pots for fun and going through exercises like making 20 mugs to get repetitiveness.
Mm-hmm.
I was single. I needed a mug. So I had 19 more mugs left to sell. So I started selling at small shows. I did like the Ithaca Festival and, you know, some local shows, really to just make it a hobby that paid for itself.
Mm-hmm.
So I bought my first wheel, my first kiln that way. And frankly, I donated the rest of the money because I had a full-time job and a salary. And so it's just donating to environmental causes with money I made from making pots.
Uh-huh. Now, so you start out making these utilitarian objects like pots and cups. When,
right.
When did you decide you wanted to become more creative?
In 2003, an artist from Taiwan came to Cornell University on a fellowship, and his name was Alion. And Cornell was generous enough to open up some workshops to the local potters. So I and a bunch of other people took some classes up there with him. And he and I really just got to be friends. We had a lot in common, love of nature, that kind of thing. So we would hang out. And so before he went to go back to Taiwan, a bunch of us had a going away party for him. And this had just kind of coincided with me leaving my full-time job. I had decided to be at least a part-time potter. So I was making pots technically as a professional for about 6 months at this point. And I thought, who better to ask about my career? So I said, Alion, what's next for me? And he looked me in the eye and he said, Eric, you need to make better pots.
Ah.
So I kind of held him to it. And the next thing I knew, my wife and I were in Taiwan. So I did a six-month residency there and studied with six different masters. And I'm sorry, four different masters for 6 months, and it was really a phenomenal experience. And so that improved my technique as well as my aesthetic, and that was the beginning of the evolution.
Uh-huh. And do you remember what your first creative piece was?
I don't know the exact piece, but the body of work that came out of the Taiwan trip was a body of work called Opened Earth, which was a series of unglazed pots that had very rough, coarse surfaces and the outside of the pot was heated on the wheel with a torch, and then as I pushed open the pot to make the form, it would crack open and expose this beautiful clay inside. So I didn't necessarily invent the technique, but it was something that resonated with me while I was in Taiwan, and I kind of gave it my own voice, and that was really my first creative experience. And I actually got really good publicity out of that back in the States. I had an article on Ceramics Monthly and the cover of Pottery Making Illustrated. So it was my first real venture into life as an artist.
It was a breakthrough, it sounds like.
It was a breakthrough of sorts. It was a middle level of work, and so people who liked it really loved it, and it didn't necessarily always resonate with the American or the Western aesthetic, which tends to be more brighter colors, shiny glazes, and things like that. Mm-hmm. So the pieces were beautiful; they would end up in exhibitions and things, but selling them, frankly, was difficult.
Huh. Now, what kinds of things did you learn in some of these intense workshops and teachings in Taiwan?
It was really fun, actually. None of the masters I studied with spoke any English, and we tried to learn Chinese, but frankly, I couldn't learn Chinese in the 3 months between Alion being here and us going to Taiwan. And so it was a lot of hands-on. Alion is fluent in English, so I did have that. But the other masters I studied with didn't speak English. And again, I didn't speak Chinese. I'm in their country. So it was a lot of laughing and gesturing and learning that way. But it was great because it was all hands-on, and that's what this medium is a hands-on medium.
And so did they teach you new techniques that you had never even thought of or heard of in this country?
They did, and it wasn't like it was all brand new. It was just different ways of doing things, like how to raise the clay up, how to manage the clay on the wheel. Here the approach is kind of to have minimal contact with the clay, where there it's to more engage the clay, and I found I had much more control and was able to get better forms out of it. And I'm kind of a hybrid now. I use some Western techniques and some of the Eastern techniques based on the type of piece I'm making. Mm-hmm. I did some Tai Chi study, and one of the masters was really good at Tai Chi and taught me a lot about how to use my body when making a pot on the wheel, which was something I wasn't doing. And that also gave me a lot more control, breathing and how I would position myself and things like that.
Uh-huh. So let's go back for 1 second. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in the fact that you said that here in the West, they teach you not to be so hands-on. How can that be with clay?
Well, you're still touching the clay, but what's typically taught, and again, this is a generalization, but what's typically taught is as you touch the clay, you often have a very light touch, because if you have any drag from your hands, it's going to wobble your pot, and you maybe just use the tips of your fingers and things like that, where what I learned in Taiwan was really just using my whole hands and gripping the clay and really, really engaging with it. So mm-hmm. really took me to a different connection level with the clay that I hadn't experienced
before. It sounds like it takes
you
back to maybe your original idea about clay.
Right.
You got so connected with it for some reason.
I got so connected, yeah. And even the Western way. I mean, there is, of course, that connection with the clay, but this really was much more engaging, I found.
Now, let's talk about the fact that, okay, so you're sitting there facing a mound of clay. Did you come to it with an idea, or does it shape itself as you work with it?
A little bit of both. Obviously, if I'm making production work, then I have a premeditated form, and I'm making the same thing over and over. And with new work, I tend to sketch a little bit, but not a lot. I really prefer a more spontaneous approach. So if I'm trying to design a new teapot, for example, I might have some ideas that have come to me, but I'm more likely to just put clay on the wheel and form it a couple of different ways until it really, you know, brings a life to itself. With my new body of work, the Trompe l'Oeil pieces that are thrown on the wheel but then carved to look like wood, those are very, very spontaneous as they happen. I sketch out a general idea because I need to know about how much clay to use and that, you know, that kind of thing, and how to do a general form. But that's very conversational. And the clay usually wins if we have an argument.
How long does it take you generally to make, say, a pot?
It would depend on the type of pot. I mean, I can throw, I do a visiting artist teaching thing up at Dryden High School based on a grant from Community Arts Partnership. And one of the jokes in the class is that I can make a 4-minute teapot, because I tend to talk a lot, if you haven't figured out already.
And, that's good on radio.
Yeah, good on radio. So as I'm doing these demos, I'm always talking to the students, and I always end up late at the end of class, and the last thing I make is a teapot. So, you know, usually the warning bell has rung, and I've got to make this teapot start to finish in 4 minutes. So not necessarily my best work, but so a mug would take, you know, maybe a minute to make, to actually make the mug on the wheel. And then there's some stuff that happens later, like a handle is put on and so on. The tree trunk work that I'm doing, the trompe-l'oeil work that I'm doing now, pieces take anywhere from 2 to 6 weeks to complete because they're all hand-carved. So the wheel throwing is really just the very beginning of the process.
Uh-huh. And then so how are you feeling doing the hand-carving? Is that an entirely different experience?
It is. It is. The last thing I ever would have imagined that I was going to be when I grew up was a sculptor. And it's really what I've turned out to be. And the current body of work is based on ancient pots from Yijing, China. They were pots from the Ming Dynasty, and they brewed tea in these tiny little teapots. And then some artists started to carve the teapots to look like trees, to try to integrate nature more into the tea ceremony. So my work is kind of derivative of that. And you don't really see a lot of it here in the States. It's more common in Asia, and I did see it in Taiwan. And it's really what Alion is known for. So as I evolved into this sculptural work, frankly, what happened was I was back from my first residency in Taiwan, and it was January, and you don't sell a lot of mugs in January. It's kind of my downtime. So I thought, I'm going to make one of those Alion-style pots and carve it to look like wood and see what happens. So I carved one up. I was pretty proud of it. I actually did two, and they both got into an exhibition up at the Birchfield Penny Museum in Buffalo. So I emailed Alion, because we keep in touch, and I said, hey, you know, look what happened. And he looked at the pots, and he said, I think you better come back to Taiwan, which was his way of saying,
really?
Not bad, but, you know, if you're going to do this, you need to work on it a little bit. So at that point, I had a daughter. My wife and I had a daughter. And so I just went and did an intensive study because it was kind of hard to travel with at that time, she was just 6 months old. Oh, so I went for a month, studied in Alion's studio, and really learned more about the carving technique. And now it's all I do. I actually am not doing any work as Muddy Paws Pottery right now. I've I found other potters to take my production business and handle my account, so I felt, you know, some loyalty to. Mm-hmm. And I'm doing just all the sculptural work now.
Oh, that's fascinating. Now since you got so interested in this art and craft, have you studied some of the history of it in different traditions?
Sure. Actually, even way back in college, I graduated from Ithaca College in 85, and I was a communications major, but studied a lot of art history. And I think it was just a class short of an art history minor, and I studied in Europe as well on a London program there. So I had a really strong art history background. I just didn't have the applied side. So with that background, I then also began to study both contemporary ceramic art as well as historical ceramic art. And both Chinese and Japanese ceramics are really the kind of the style and the influence that comes out in my work.
Mm-hmm. And are you interested in sculpture like Michelangelo and then some of the traditional European?
Yeah. In fact, Michelangelo is probably my biggest non-ceramic inspiration. I really connect with him a lot. I've read a lot about him, including the history of the letters that were found of his, Stone's book, and, you know, the normal kind of Michelangelo stuff. And the guy's just fascinating. In fact, I use him a lot when my wife is on my case for spending too much time in the studio or getting too involved in a piece of work, because he was the type of person who really just got totally absorbed in it and shut out the world. So I can kind of say, hey, even the greats did this, so okay, give me a break. Let me stay in the studio some more.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Eric Saratella. He's a potter and a creative ceramic artist. I want to talk to you about, are you like so many artists that I've talked to? Do you feel things brewing inside you and you just have to run and get your hands in the clay?
I do. And again, it drives my wife, Julie, nuts sometimes. And I should say, before I forget, that she is extremely, extremely supportive. I'm really blessed to have a supportive spouse who really, as much as I joke around, really does give me the time and space I need to create the work. Stuff will come to me, ideas will come to me, and I sometimes just immediately need to get my hands in clay. I can't sleep. You know, my head is spinning.
It doesn't happen on planes, right? I mean, at least if you're a writer, you can pick up a pen.
Yeah, you can pick up a pen, right. Fortunately, I can usually find clay, and I do sometimes sketch things out, but it's really best when I can just kind of get into my own studio.
I want to go back to this Taiwan influence. Mm-hmm. You say you begin each day by brewing Taiwanese tea in the Kung Fu manner.
Right.
To tell us what that means.
Well, the Kung Fu style of brewing tea, it has nothing to do with the martial arts. It's just the same words. But it means, it translates really to with great care. And it's about brewing tea very carefully and really bringing out the full essence of the tea. And in southern China and Hong Kong and Taiwan, they brew tea in this method, and it's brewed in tiny little teapots. The teapot is filled very full with leaves, usually an oolong tea or a green tea, and I really like the oolong teas. And hot water is poured over the teapot, and then it's poured into tiny cups, walnut-sized cups.
Mm.
And you just drink a little bit at a time, and then you just continue to brew the tea, so you're always getting fresh tea, as opposed to a Western style or even other parts of China where you would brew a larger kind of tea bowl or mug of tea. So this is more about little cups and really getting all the essence out of the tea. Tasting it almost like we do wine here. You smell the nose, you look at the color, you roll it across your tongue. So it's, for me, it's a great transition from morning time with my daughter and then kind of transitioning into a more creative space. So it gives me kind of a break to transition in.
Now, it goes without saying you must be influenced by the wonderland of nature here in the Finger Lakes.
Sure.
To tell us how that has influenced your work as well.
It's just a direct influence. I hike all the time. We kayak. I've spent most of my life in the woods. Trees have always been really, really important to me. Again, on a more spiritual side, I can really feel the energy in trees. I can touch them and get a different sense of rhythm from them. I proposed to my wife in a tree. We got married under that same tree. So they've always been really integral.
I'm not even going to ask you how you ended up in a tree.
Actually, we were in the tree. We were sitting in this tree talking, and I knew I was going to propose that night. And I waited till we got out of the tree so that, good or bad, I didn't want her to fall out of the tree, depending on what her response was.
That is very unique, you must admit.
So anyway, to be in the Finger Lakes and walk around in the woods and see, weathered logs, which are a real strong influence in the current body of work. So I'm really trying to communicate about the beauty in nature, even with all the disregard we humans show the earth. Mm-hmm. Nature is still beautiful, and it's really representing, for me, represented by these weathered logs. So a lot of that comes right out of hikes and walks on the Finger Lakes Trail and up in Connecticut Hill, which is up behind our house. Huge influence on me, as well as all the water in the Finger Lakes, because when you really look at these pieces closely, the carving in the bark is really flowing like water. So kayaking on the lakes, being in rivers, those sort of things all really show up in the creative side and the craftsmanship in the pieces.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's a quote in, you have an essay on your website. It says, "I appreciate how pottery reflects the earth's durability and fragility, strong yet easily destroyed if disrespected." On that note, are you involved in environmental issues as well?
I have been quite a bit in the past. Currently now with a full-time job as an artist, which is a huge amount of work. Our daughter is now three, but as I started a family, I actually stepped back a little bit. But I was quite involved in the Finger Lakes Land Trust for a while. When I was at the ad agency, I also was the vice president of Tanglewood Nature Center, which is in Elmira, which is where the ad agency that I worked for was located. So those are some direct things. And then I was also, as I mentioned, doing a lot of donating to environmental organizations, both on the local level and on the national level. So things like Finger Lakes Land Trust, which is a great organization, as well as World Wildlife and National Wildlife and, those sort of organizations. Mm-hmm. So it's nature and the planet's always been really important to me.
Uh-huh. It should be to all of us.
Yeah.
But I would say. Now, you've served as a visiting artist at Dryden High School and other places. How do teenage kids react to this craft?
Kids seem to really, really like it. I think because it is such a hands-on method of expressing yourself, and there are so many ways to do it. You can do it on the wheel. You can do a pinch pot like you would do as a kid with Play-Doh. You can do coil. You can cast clay. I mean, it's just so versatile that it seems like most students can really find some way of working in clay that really works for them. And it's very expressive. It's three-dimensional, and probably a little bit resonant of everybody growing up with Play-Doh and Silly Putty and, you know, those sort of things. So there's
for Mother's Day.
Making ashtrays for Mother's Day, right. So, you know, it's a fun art form at very least.
Uh-huh. I was wondering in this high-tech world whether kids would resonate with them. This kind of, and dirty, they probably, you know, some kids,
yeah,
messy.
I don't really see that much. And of course, it's a little bit biased because I'm in a ceramics class and these students have chosen to take this class. You know, I suppose there are people that wouldn't want to get their hands dirty. But I think that's part of the fun of it maybe in this high-tech age is there's still that innate work with your hands. You know, we're not that far from the cave people in you know, real time. So, you know, to work with your hands and be creative and construct things, I think is not really bred out of us yet.
Now, when you're creating pieces, do you always think in terms of wanting to sell them, or are you thinking more now that you've been doing this for a while in regard to museums and collections?
Now I'm focusing a little bit more on museums and high-end private collections. I'm making work that's truer to myself, where frankly in the production days I used, you know, blue glaze and green glaze, you know, things that sold.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And I don't really have to do that anymore, and that's really nice. So I'm a little bit more liberated and free in terms of being to create what I want, what comes from my heart, and then from there go and find the buyers or the collections for it.
Uh-huh. So. Now let's talk a little bit about the fact that you're curating a show for the Johnson Museum that's coming up in July. July 6th or July 8th?
I think July 5th is the opening. It'll be publicized, but the big summer opening that happens at the Johnson every year will include this show, and it's called Ithaca Ceramics.
Uh-huh.
And it's been a blast of a project. I had approached the Johnson, Ellen Averill, who's a chief curator. I approached her about it about a year and a half ago and said, hey, we have all these great ceramic artists in the area that nobody really knows about. A lot of the potters are known about, and they make great work and sell at the farmer's market and so on, but there's this whole subgroup of ceramic artists who are exhibiting on a national level that a lot of locals don't necessarily know about because Ithaca being small in market, some of them sell here, but we have to go outside in order to have enough buyers because there's just not the population here. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to really expose the Ithaca community to the fact that there are all these talented ceramic artists in town that they might not be aware of, as well as help elevate ceramic art as an art form, where in the East, if you're a ceramic artist or a potter, you're considered an artist, where typically in the West, it's considered more of a craft. And, you know, the craft versus art thing is a whole nother discussion, but in my eyes, there really isn't a difference. They're both related, and ceramic art, working in clay, really is an art form. And so this is a way of at least my little contribution to kind of elevating ceramic art.
Mm-hmm.
The Johnson was extremely receptive about it. We're going to have, it's either 12 or 14, I forget off the top of my head, ceramic artists from the area. We'll have Julie Crosby, Carrie Joseph, Julie Johnson, Mark Keen, Momoko Takeshita Keen, Jeremiah Donovan,
Names will become known.
Yeah, these names will, and many of them are known on kind of a national basis. Many of these artists are in national exhibitions and showing at high-end shows and galleries.
Uh-huh.
So it's going to be a very diverse show.
I want to ask you, what do you look for when you're curating? Did you get to pick out the pieces?
I did. Well, we did a little bit of both. I kind of picked out the artists based on either knowing them or knowing of their work. And then Ellen and I visited each studio to get a sense of what that artist was currently working on. And then just gave them a general idea of what we wanted, more based on us being able to fill the space well. So we really are leaving the final choice of the piece up to the artist because we want them to choose what they feel represents them well.
Mm-hmm.
And we're giving them some guidelines to kind of just make sure it all fits in the gallery space. So it's been really fun, really, really fun to put together.
So is it going to mainly be creative pieces? I mean, you said you don't differentiate between utilitarian and creative pieces. It's all an art, right?
Right, right.
So this will represent utilitarian pieces as well as art pieces?
It's going to be both, yeah. Because some of these artists are making utilitarian functional work and some are just working more in expressive works. I think the biggest difference between it and what the show and what you might see at one of the local retail stores is, in this case, the functional forms, the emphasis is really on the form as opposed to the function. So it's really more about the expressiveness. It might show up in the form of a teapot or a tea bowl or a vessel that one could call a vase, but it's really more about the expressiveness as opposed to, for example, when I was making pots as Mighty Paws Pottery, if I made a teapot or a mug, I was more interested in the balance and how the handle felt and things like that, where now when I make a teapot, I'm more interested in the balance and the flow, but more visually, which sometimes also ends up being a very balanced pot to handle, but oftentimes is not. So again, this emphasis at the Johnson is more on the form than the function, although many pieces will be functional.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, when you meet young people who are interested in going into this profession, what is the kind of stuff do you tell them?
Wow, good question. I think the most important thing is to be true to your heart and express yourself from what's coming inside. I'm a big believer in the do what you want and the money will follow concept. That doesn't mean you don't have to make some sacrifices along the way. I worked many years as a production potter and loved it, and used a blue glaze that isn't one I necessarily wanted in my home, but it sold. And, you know, frankly, we all need to pay the bill. So it's not to say you don't make compromises, but in the end, not to make pieces that you think will sell, but make what you love, mm-hmm. and then find the market for it instead mm-hmm. of vice versa.
And do you think it's important for people to study formally? When I had a glass artist on, he thought for sure you have to study with a master.
I do think it's important to study formally. Yeah, I don't know that it's necessary to go to art school, although I'd recommend it. You know, in hindsight, I wish I had known I had this in me and could have gone to art school, and I certainly can go back now and think about that. But I took a kind of an accelerated path by going to Taiwan. That was my art school. So some sort of formal study, whether the way I did it or by going to art school, is a definite. The historical perspective is really important. Working with many different teachers is important, so you're not just too much like one teacher. Mm-hmm. I think it really helps to create your own voice by having multiple influences. So all that helps in school and formal teachings and trainings.
So this discovering ceramics opened you up in some way. Do you feel like you're still on a path where you might find another creative outlet in the arts that you might discover that you are akin to?
You know, at this point, I don't see myself working in anything other than clay. And 5 years ago, I didn't see myself as anything other than a humble production potter. And so, you know, I know now to never say never. It's this whole career for me has been very spontaneous, again, because it wasn't really a premeditated thing. It just kind of happened. That I'm really open to anything. My current love is clay, and at least for the foreseeable future, I plan to work in clay. I do plan to continue on the sculptural route that I'm doing now. I've got some ideas for some larger installations. I actually got another grant from Community Arts Partnership to begin exploring a new body of work, kind of within the trompe l'oeil carved work, but larger museum installation style pieces, and I'm seeking additional funding to be able to, you know, kind of continue that exploration. So it's pretty open.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. We have run out of time. Eric Saratella, thank you so much and good luck. We look forward to some of your future work.
Thanks so much for having me.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes in Corning, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.